Time in every man's life when he must face the fact that it's time for the next episode of Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 279. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me today is Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
James Jones.
Hi.
And John Lindemann.
Johnny, you are brutally handsome, but I am terminally pretty.
Ho-ho! What a couple we make. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, we have a wonderful show for you. We're going to finally get back to listener mail in the second half, but first up is new business, in which we talk about the games we have played recently. James has a brand new Wii game. Let me just repeat that. A brand new Wii game to talk about this week.
Well, that would be true if we haven't talked about it on the show already, so...
Yeah, there is that caveat.
There is a certain disconnect here between your statement and reality. But what I have isn't even brand new, because it's not out yet, technically. Yeah, take that. Rhythm Heaven Fever. Rhythm Heaven Wii, or whatever the hell you want to call it. It's the Rhythm Heaven game that is on the Wii.
Mine no Rhythm Tengoku.
So, this is Rhythm Heaven. If you're listening to this show, you probably know what Rhythm Heaven is, because you probably heard Greg talk about it. But even before that, you probably played the DS game. And if you're really devoted, like me, you probably played the GBA game. And if you didn't, I have no respect for you. But what Rhythm Heaven is, for those who aren't with it, is a series of mini-games, not micro-games, but it is produced by the people who made the WarioWare game, built around the player engaging in activities that are in beat with the rhythm of the song that goes with each game. At the conclusion of a series of four games, all those games are mixed together and they're put into some crazy long play song called The Remix. Essentially, as you clear one game, you gain access to the next until such a point that you reach the end of Rhythm Heaven.
After Rhythm Heaven, do you go to Rhythm Hell?
Yes. Actually, trying to get perfect scores would be Rhythm Hell.
Oh.
I've been through it all nine circles.
It is pretty daunting. So, this is the third Rhythm Heaven game, if you might have surmised from my previous discussion of two Rhythm Heaven games before this one.
There is the arcade one.
Yeah, I'm not going to count it.
Well, no, you did count the arcade ones for the Mario Kart.
Let me finish my statement. I'm not going to count it since Nintendo apparently won't count the arcade games for Mario Kart.
That's right.
Okay, so it's Nintendo that's forcing you to be inconsistent.
Exactly. If Nintendo would be honest with themselves and with everyone around them.
They're a fundamentally dishonest company.
This would be the fourth Rhythm Heaven
thanks,
game.
Newt Gingrich.
I'm looking forward to F-Zero 9, by the way.
There you go. So... What makes Rhythm Heaven appealing is a few facets here. One, they're just generally fun games that are challenging. Never let it be said, this team can't make good minigames. They also integrate very well with the music, which is usually entertaining in some mechanism. And the game has this kind of weird sense of humor. They always have really high presentation value. And I have to say, the Wii game has easily the highest presentation value, which makes sense. It's on the Wii. But it's also added some... decently good localization. Like, there is some legitimately funny text in this game.
But don't they localize the music, too?
They do, and that's always kind of...
And some are more necessary than others.
Right, some of them, the instructions for what you should do are actually in the lyrics of the song. At which point, you have to.
Hmm.
Of course, most of the music in the game doesn't have lyrics. That's not an issue.
Okay,
yeah.
But some of the remixes actually have, you know, a full lyrical complement that goes with them, and they usually get localized. But actually, one of the games that I'll talk about to give a good example of what this game is like, well, I'll just read the description. The game is called Love Rap.
Oh, my favorite genre.
And it reads, love, exclamation point. It's the most powerful feeling in the world, period.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there's no better way to express it than through the ancient art of hip-hop.
Mm-hmm.
That is all the preface you get going into Love Rap. I mean, that's awesome. All you know. That's all the game feels the need to tell you.
I didn't have any for that.
Yeah.
If it's the one I'm thinking, all I had to go on was die, suki, die, suki, die, suki, must die, suki.
So in Love Rap, you play as one of two possibly mentally incapacitated individuals standing next to a car.
What are you saying about rappers?
A female is sitting on the hood of said car, repeating phrases such as,
Daisuki?
So the phrases are literally all about you, really all about you, faux show.
Faux show!
Nice.
But essentially what happens is, she says her line, and you have to hit A as soon as she finishes it, so you can repeat it in rhythm with the guy next to you, mm-hmm. because you can say nothing original. It is a truly bizarre game. And I struggled with the faux shows because they're so fast you don't have much time to react to them.
Very realistic.
And the game responded that with its text at the end, you did okay, but your faux shows need work.
Yeah. Well, that says a lot about you as a person, James.
See, that is the kind of feedback that I wasn't getting in the Japanese version. Yeah, so I imagine you're going to get all the perfects far quicker than I ever did.
No.
That kind of coaching, elite coaching.
Yeah, it really helps out. I mean, like I said, the presentation value of this game pretty much destroys its predecessors. I mean,
it does.
Graphically, it's really sharp. The art is really colorful. It's really attractive. The music is easily the best in the series. And like I said, although Greg doesn't have experience with it, the writing is actually really funny, if kind of stupid. But My personal favorite, and most people who follow this game have seen this one, is the game called Ringside, in which you play as a very incredibly muscular and very sweaty wrestler in a luchador mask while he's being interviewed by a small girl. It's absurd. It's the most. If you haven't seen the video of it, you really need to go look up Rhythm Heaven Ringside, because it's A, it's caused all kinds of parodies online, but B, it's mentally deranged. It's so weird that it came up in the Iwata asks when he wanted to know where that game came from. It's delightful and bizarre, and we get to live from the ringside. We hear the champ's innermost thoughts and feelings after the match. All he ever says to response to interviews is yes.
I have a practical question. Does this game use the Wii Remote speaker?
No, not that I have observed. It makes strangely aggressive use of the rumble, though. Like, coming into menus, it starts to rumble. You're like, what the fuck?
Yeah, I was wondering, because if you think about it, the audio in the remote speaker comes directly from the system, so that would circumvent any kind of lag induced by your audio-video setup. You know, even if you have surround sound, it would be faster than that, depending on how the stuff is, you know, uncompressed once it hits your remote. But I just wonder if that could be used as a tool. But then at the same time, if you do have lag in your system, it might be something that you can adjust to over time, like you can anticipate the lag. Whereas if you have, like, conflicting cues from your remote speaker that's, like, you know, half a second ahead of when the stuff comes out of the TV.
It just sounds so terrible as well.
Yeah, I mean, the audio here is so good.
You have got to kind of become immersed in it, because obviously you need to get that rhythmic synchronization. And the thing is, just so the sound quality of the Wii Remote speaker is so god-awful.
Yeah, and I'm not suggesting the music be played out of the remote. I'm suggesting that maybe some kind of metronome type effect.
No, but even if it was just a rhythm element to it, I think it would be difficult because it would sound so bad.
Right.
But I mean, the lag issue, I think you'd best be sort of mindful of it, because I know I was mostly played this through my television on my headphones. So, you know, I've got a cordless headset that it plugs into the TV, and then, you know, I could just sit back without being tethered to it.
I've thought about those many times.
But, I mean, the point is that there was a big difference. If I plugged them straight into the TV's headphone jack, it was fine. But then there was one time where I plugged it into myself Amp's headphone jack, which is connected to the TV via an optical cable. And all of a sudden, all those songs I was really good at, I couldn't do it anymore.
Right. It probably is something that, if you had always played it through the amp,
I might well have been able to adjust to it.
Because a lot of these, right. You're actually pressing at a certain point after a beat. So, like there is a certain amount of weight you have to have in there anyway. So, we'd just be like, well, it's a little bit less.
And I'm sure that lag wasn't caused by the fiber optical cable. It was probably the whatever signal conditioning the amplifier was doing.
The amp, yeah, exactly. That's what I would have thought. The optical cable itself would be too quick.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's light. I mean, it's speed of light.
The
literally.
Point is, for anybody that's got, you know, like a system like that, and it's through optical or something, it's the fact that optical cable is really quick doesn't necessarily mean that you wouldn't get lag.
Right.
Now, what I would say about this game is I feel like it's harder than Rhythm Heaven on the DS or Gold in Japan, but it may just be that there's more stuff early on that's difficult. So there's a level that is called Monkey Watch, which should pretty much tell Greg which one it is.
Yeah, oh yeah, I talked about this one the last time.
Yeah, that one's a bastard. And then it goes on for, it's a long level too. It's about a minute and a half. So, I mean, and if you get off a little bit, you have to try to get back in rhythm. A lot of these, you're tapping out a rhythm just continuously, and then an event transpires that makes you change off that rhythm, and then you have to get back on. The difficulty is if you fall off the rhythm, getting back on can actually be kind of hard. Hmm. I actually found that even Built to Scale, which is an old Starwalt of the series, I was actually worse at in this game than I've been in any of them. But it also came much later. It came in Remix 3, where Built to Scale is usually like the first thing in the game.
Is that the one where you build the robots?
No, that's the one where you bounce the bolt back and forth, and then at the end you shoot it between two widgets.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah.
The robots are in there too, the Screwbot Factory.
So they do repeat events, just like in WarioWare.
Some of them are more different than others, you know, I mean, like the one with the seals is very reminiscent of previous Rhythm Heaven games where you'd have a drill sergeant telling people to march, except right. This time they did it with seals rolling instead of people marching and things, you know, so some of them just do a different riff, or there's the one with the birds that's a bit like Lockstep, but it's not quite Lockstep.
No, and thank God it's not Lockstep.
Well, they will all be new to me. I'm looking forward to this game. Once Mass Effect 3 comes out on March 6th and my New Year's resolution is complete, I'll probably be picking this up because I like the price and it sounds good. And I'd rather play this on console on my couch than hunched over a DS.
It's a discount game, and you only have to play it with the Wii Remote, which means you can kind of sit there idly. And I mean, really, you're just tapping out on the A and occasionally the B button. Now, what I've always thought was kind of weird since I've started playing it is that it doesn't use the B button in games that I've perceived. It uses A and B together.
Yeah, you never use the B button separately. It's basically you either just tap A or you pinch.
It's really kind of weird, but I guess they had a reason.
It must be just something about the fact that they probably didn't want, you know, a lot of different inputs. You know, they wanted to keep it even more simple than the GBA game, which had A and B mostly, but you'd still have the D-pad coming into play every now and again. So with this, they basically just went with just two inputs, and rather than sort of having the second input be B on its own, I guess they felt that the pinching sort of action was maybe more satisfying in some way for the sorts of things that they do with it.
The only other thing I could think of is that when you press the A button, the remote doesn't go down because your finger's on the B button. If you press the B button, you will raise the remote a bit. Actually, I will read about the seals one, though, because I did enjoy this. Quote, "We may look cute, fluffy lumps of joy, but we're a grizzled expedition team. We train hard and always follow our captain's orders." Which you then proceed to have a seal dance. So I'm not sure where they get their grizzled expedition experience from.
It's that sort of Jets and the Sharks kind of grizzled, isn't it?
It's called Happy Fins. So penguins dance at the South Pole and seals dance at the North Pole.
It's this fantastically weird game that I wouldn't have any other way. There's been a little frustration. Occasionally you'll hit a song that just utterly befuddles you. For me, it was Remix 3 that for whatever reason just gave me nightmares. But once I got through it, I then cleared the next three remixes in one sitting. So, I mean, I don't know. You can actually skip them if you fail enough times. There's a thing called the cafe, and you talk to the person in the cafe, and they say, well, you're having problems. Do you want me to show you how to do it, or do you want to just skip it?
That's nice, because that was a big complaint about the DS game, right? If you got stuck.
Yeah, the thing is, that feature was in the DS game, going to the barista. It was I never knew about it in the GBA game, because it was in Japanese. Yes. So when it was in the DS game, I just assumed it wasn't. Because I'd played that game as if I were playing the GBA game, even though that was in English. And then, of course, this time with the Wii game, I knew of the feature would be in there somewhere, but I never resorted to it, and it probably would have been a pain to do it. But it's there. You could skip something if it's giving you a problem. And it's not like you have to get the top grade. You could just get a pass, and then that's enough to go to the next level. Mm-hmm. And then you could try for the excellence if you really want to.
Yeah, I think in the case of that, like I said, some of these seem to be more strict about what is pass and what is fail than others. And that one was a little bit stricter than some of the others.
and it's not transparent.
No.
It's degrading at all. So, you know, there's no meter on the side that gives you some idea of like how well you've been doing or anything. You know, it's kind of kept all organic and stuff. But what that means is that sometimes you might think, well, you know, hang on a minute. I did that really well and I failed. And then, you know,
no, you didn't.
You might do it like a bit better and get an excellent or something. I mean, sometimes it's that marginal.
I failed Love Rap because I got all three right pretty much every time except for the faux shows. So it very much explicitly told me that my faux shows need work. But a lot of times it could be much more obtuse. In the remixes, it'll usually just go, that could be better, try again.
John, are you surprised that James failed Love Rap?
No.
I'm not either.
Yeah, I'd expect him to go in there and be like, have you ever met a girl that you try on a date? You know what I mean? So.
Yeah, when he should go, I need love. Okay,
that's
so
right.
Greg, you're up next.
Fair enough. First of all, I wanted to have a quick little funny follow-up from the bucket list thing we did a couple of weeks ago.
We got such great emails, by the way. People offering to allow us into their homes to play all the games they have that we have
road
never
trip.
Played. So
stalkers.
We got some really great emails and Twitter comments and forum posts and all kinds of crazy stuff. I think I was offered a copy of Final Fantasy V Advance by at least four different people. So thank you all very much. I will probably just wait until I can get my own copy because it'll take me a long time to play through it. But we have some really polite and very generous listeners. So thanks everybody for your comments there.
Well, anyway, so it was a bit after the episode went up, and I thought, you know what, for a laugh, let's just have a look. What's the current state of play with Ninja 5.0 on eBay?
Mm.
So, put a search in. Just by coincidence, an auction must have just gone up for a good condition copy with the box of Ninja 5.0 from someone who lives in the same county here in England as me.
So was it Ninja Cop?
No, it was the American version.
Ah, A kindred spirit, Greg.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, he's got the American version there, but obviously either one would have been just as good. So I thought, well, I have to come back and check in a few days, you know, see if it's developing, see if it's going to be in my price range. At that point, I think there'd already been a couple of opening bids, and it was somewhere between 25 and 30 quid. So still, you know, very reasonable at that point, but you're expecting it to go up. I come back towards the end, and do you know where it hit? £137 is what it sold for, which for my American friends is over $215 at the current exchange rate.
Jesus! And that's not even a sealed copy, right?
No, not sealed. It's used. It was transferred. It was good condition. But
good God!
So why did you pay $217 for it? Exactly?
I didn't. That is out of my range.
I question. I'm really beginning to question your commitment to Sparkle Motion, Greg.
Oh, that is. I think that I could pick up a few of those other items on the list. Yeah. That money.
A lot of them for that.
You could fill that bucket.
Yeah, so I just thought it'd be funny to relate. It's like, you know, you always hear that it's really bad. Maybe I'll just get lucky. Nah, no, it's really bad. So yeah, that was kind of depressing. But after that, I've been finishing off Revelations that I talked about last week. So I'll just quickly kind of provide some wrap up on that. First of all, story mode, finished it off. Really kind of just went along embellishing kind of what I was talking about last week. I think the concluding parts on the ship and stuff kind of upped the ante quite nicely and finished in a mostly satisfying way. Some big boss fight kind of stuff. Definitely what the game had been doing well, so taken up a notch. And then the last chapter that was away from the main action, in this case it was set in the past, was probably the worst one of the lot. It was really bad. They really, those missions where you're just kind of killing stuff and hanging around, they went from being, you know, a change of pace to just slowing down the pace to padding.
That's what you want, right? I mean, that's the goal, just to pad the game.
It's kind of tough for me because you've got a game here. Obviously, it's not of the length and scope of RE4, but it is on a portable game. So I don't know whether people are necessarily expecting that, but that's kind of, I think, some of where they've tried to make up the deficits with those kinds of missions. But the thing is, you have also got the raid mode, which I started fiddling with sort of after I finished the story, which, you know, offers significant capacity for continuing to play the game, and you could play it online or locally with a friend that's got a copy or whatever, you know. So if you're worried about the whole, you know, people are just going to trade it in or whatever, I would have thought raid mode is the more effective device for that, rather than just padding the campaign by a couple of hours or so with some of this stuff. But having played a bit of raid mode now, I think I'm going to get into it more than I ever did with Mercenaries on RE4. Because I touched that once or twice just to see what it was, and then never played it again. And not that I, you know, thought, oh, well, that's rubbish, let's forget that, but it just didn't really compel me to play it, and I moved on to other things. Mm-hmm. The thing is, with it being portable and whatnot, I can imagine this is the sort of thing that I just might dip into a little bit here, that, you know, these, basically what you've got is these little cut-ups from levels in the campaign mode. You just go through a sort of limited section, killing a few enemies. Sometimes you have like a little task to do or a boss enemy to kill. And you're just accruing experience points all the time. And so after each level, you know, it tallies them up, and you can use them to buy stuff in the shop, which also has items that are purchasable through game coins as well, in a kind of weird mixing up. Not many, but there's some. You could buy like a weapon for 10 game coins or something. And then also you'll get new weapons, and you'll get these sort of perks, these enhancements for your weapons, which is the only kind of real inventory management the game has, which is each weapon has a certain amount of slots that you can put these little stat buffs on them, like, you know, higher critical hit percentage or higher stun rate or, you know, higher rate of fire, longer magazine, all these kind of things. And it does kind of put the whole game in more of an action RPG kind of context, very sort of stat based. And, you know, I think maybe it accounts for some of that less kind of physical, visceral feeling in the main game, as it seems to have a kind of a statistically driven kind of mentality to it that becomes much more apparent in the raid mode, where you could see, you know, the numbers are coming out of the enemies and all that, because it's not worried about being atmospheric anymore or anything. Mm-hmm. You know, you could just see how much you're killing them and all that. And it's so far, I've just leveled up a bit and stuff, and it's quite nice to be able to get that sense of progression, and quite quickly you start building up more guns, more stat enhancements, and so you can customize and really kind of express yourself a lot more. You could do that to some extent in the campaign, but the breadth of weapons is not quite the same. You've got quite a lot of wacky stuff here that I hadn't seen in the main game, and also you've got different characters that have little special abilities, like someone will reload shotguns faster, or they've got different melee weapons or things like that. So it's not anything I'm going to play very regularly or, you know, for a very long time, I don't think, mainly because I think it probably would be fun to play co-op, but I really can't. I mean, you can play anonymous things online, but I don't really see the point. You can't communicate with them. It may as well just be a sort of AI buddy.
Who says it isn't?
But it, I mean, it sounds like it will kind of do the job in terms of having you keep the game a bit longer.
I could just keep it in the rotation in terms of, yeah, I wouldn't get rid of it anyway. I might replay it on hard one day or something. I mean, I enjoyed the main game well enough to do that if I've got a paucity of other things to play.
And yours is spelled right too, so.
Yeah, they just went with the logo on the side rather than text typed
so
out.
So I'm holding an American copy right now, and I'm looking at the spine and giggling. But I'm also looking at the back, and I'm baffled by the absolute lack of text on the back describing the game.
Like I said, I've been pretty pleased with it. I think I'm going to get more out of this raid mode, but it's a shame. I think cooperatively it would be pretty fun, but online, unless you were going to kind of set up a play date scenario, as Johnny likes to say, and, you know, maybe arrange to talk over Skype or something, then I could see it being fun. You know, so maybe some people will be able to do that. I don't think I will.
Well, this Nintendo Network thing will be great one day.
One online Nintendo venture that I finally got around to sampling is the demos, because, of course, I didn't get the RE demo because I felt I'd already played it. But there was a new one that went up today that I wanted to talk about from Sega, which is Crush 3D.
Really? Who's picking these?
Someone that's good buddies with Sega, apparently.
It's truly bizarre.
But, so it was an interesting choice. It's been out over here already. I understand it's not out in America yet.
I'm looking forward to it.
It got delayed, didn't it? But
yes.
For some reason, originally it was going to come out significantly earlier, even than it came out here. But it, along with Shinobi, I think, got delayed. You know, there was a lot of stuff that got delayed when the 3DS was struggling. If you remember, Cave Story, Shinobi, and this, I believe. But then it got delayed again in the States for whatever reason. But it did come out in January here. So this is actually a demo here of a game that has already hit the stores. But I've been interested in this because Crush, when it came out on the PSP, was actually quite an acclaimed game. It got good reviews. It's basically a 3D puzzle platformer where you sort of are playing with dimensions a lot. The core mechanic is, I get, a little bit analogous to what you see in Super Paper Mario, but very much more important and fleshed out. And around that's really what the puzzles are based around. And the interesting thing I've noticed actually now looking at this version is that it has got a significant facelift from the PSP game for the 3DS in terms of the aesthetic. If you remember, Crush for the PSP had this kind of dark fantasy, surrealist kind of thing going on, a bit Tim Burton, you know, all that kind of. Mm-hmm. Well, here it's very much more it's still surreal, but it's very much more a sort of bright, happy kind of surrealism. For whatever reason, they made that change. But basically, you're playing as this sort of little Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy chap who's prancing about in his dressing gown, trapped inside his own head, having to recover his marbles, see what they did there, to get to the exit of all these levels that are part of his brain somehow. But the core mechanic that I referenced is that you can, at any moment, with a press of a shoulder button, essentially collapse this 3D world into a 2D plane. And so, for instance, if you're trying to get to a platform that's, you know, over in the distance, if you, first of all, using the D-pad, rotate the view so you're looking at things correctly, and then collapse, or crush, as the title would suggest, everything down into that 2D plane, well, then a platform that was in the distance can become a bridge to that place that you want to go.
Yeah, it's very similar to Electrochrome, although I think Crush, the original PSP version of Crush, actually came out before Electrochrome, but it is somewhat similar. Electrochrome is more of a straight puzzle game. There's not really any platforming in it.
Is that Echochrome?
Echochrome, sorry.
Yeah.
Echochrome is the game you were thinking of, yes. But if we're going to talk about bad names, let's give Crushed its due, putting a pun in there.
It's not Crushed, it's Crushed 3D.
Yeah, it's written like Crushed.
I know it is, but I spoke with a producer at E3, and he said Crushed 3D.
I know, but it was very deliberate.
It looks like Crushed with a terrible backwards E.
But I always thought that was a cool concept to build a game around, and having been able to play the demo now, which is basically a sort of tutorial on about three levels, it's been very much confirmed for me. And of course, it's one of those things that clearly it's a natural fit for the 3DS in terms of this whole idea that you're playing spatial kind of reasoning puzzles, switching between 3D and 2D. It's not as if you need a stereoscopic display by any means, but it does kind of make it more intuitive. You know, this whole idea, I think, could be kind of a bit abstruse. Perhaps it makes it a bit more physical and easier to grasp if you're looking at it in 3D. You know, kind of like pull blocks is similar. Well, Pushmo is similar, isn't it? I mean, you could do that on anything and it would still work, but I think it's nice that it has the stereoscopic display. It just kind of embellishes what's going on. Mm-hmm. And makes it perhaps just a little bit more intuitive. So it's something I'm keeping my eye on. Now, having said that, there are some reviews that kind of say that it doesn't necessarily develop on its ideas as well as it might in terms of puzzles towards the end. They get more difficult, but in a way that's not necessarily more satisfying to solve, but just more kind of painstaking. So that's kind of soured me on going out and getting it straight away. And in fact, it seems to have suffered a similar fate to Shinobi, in that it's one of those, actually, there's not that many 3DS games this is true of, in my experience, at least ones that are of any merit, that has already started to sink in price quite quickly. So, yeah, at a time when I am more in need of a new 3DS game, having just dealt with Revelations and whatnot, I think I'll be coming back to this because it seems ripe with possibilities for some really fiendishly clever stuff that you know, environmental puzzles that you could create using this whole dimension switching, which I said you've got a lot of control over it. You know, because you're in a 360 degrees 3D environment, you know, you can view it from above and collapse it so that all that vertical real estate just becomes a flat plane mm-hmm. as well. So there's one example, for instance, where you kind of had to go around this sort of giant soda can and push it in the right way so that it sort of falls into a gap, and then you rotate the level, crush it all together again, and then that soda can becomes a step on your way to the exit. You know, just a very basic example, but it's I'm quite enamored with the concept, and I generally like this kind of platform puzzler kind of spatial reasoning thing in a lot of other cases as well. So the demo has convinced me that it's definitely worth keeping an eye on.
Cool. All right. So John, what do you have this week?
Yeah, I have a little emulator on Windows Phone 7, of all things.
You thief!
I'm typically not a big emulator guy. All of my ROMs are backups from games that I own, James. Don't you realize that?
Liar!
Well, also, I mean, do you really have to rob games to play when you have so many that were perfectly legitimately obtained that have not been played?
Seriously, I mean,
well,
you own...
Know, let me tell you, Greg, I have backed up every single one of them as well, just in case there's a flood, something like that. They're in the
vault. In some cases, the method by which he backs them up is to buy an extra copy.
Yeah, oblivion. Yeah.
You're totally wrong, Johnny, but anyways. That is an apocryphal story
all,
at best.
All of
but
John's cats have Halo helmets.
Only the ones I like. Okay. So this is, it's called, of all things, it's called Sonic's Jewels.
Get out. We're done. Yes. No, we're done.
It's a nesticle for a new generation, right?
It's for Game Gear and the venerable Sega Master System.
And those are, weren't those pretty much the
same
thing?
Which is essentially just a Game Gear.
Yeah, I think the Game Gear, I think the hardware is slightly better, I think.
Hmm. I thought it was slightly worse.
Well, I imagine it's more low res, probably. But
yeah, that was the issue, was that it was had a lower res screen than your television. But
it
yeah.
might actually have been more powerful in some ways.
Any yep. Master System emulator, I believe, will play Game Gear games simply because they're the same.
Yeah. So this was a trip for me because, you know, that was actually, I bought one of these before I owned an NES.
Wait, hold on, wait, because that we have to discuss your judgment there first.
I agree. Well, see, this is the whole thing, right? Which will probably surprise nobody, is I was caught up in the hardware specs versus the NES. I was like, you know, I put them down and I'm like, oh, okay, you know.
Goddamn Canadians.
The hardware specs are better, so that means the games are going to be better. So I went out, bought one, and the games were like a trickle. There was like hardly any games out for it. Meanwhile, the NES.
Hey, there was the karate game that was just a foot drawn on the box.
Oh, yeah. It had some of the worst box art ever.
It was
really
amazing.
Like looking back, I mean, back then I was young, stupid, I didn't know any better.
It was graph paper with badly drawn body parts.
Oh, it's terrible. Terrible. And let me tell you, after having some of the legal backups that I have loaded onto this device, those games really weren't that good.
No,
a lot of them just really weren't good at all.
Before we continue though, let's discuss the Master System briefly. Because that system was a piece of crap.
It really was. There's a reason why it got killed in the U.S. marketplace. I mean, it really did not have a lot of good games for it.
If you've never seen a Master System, I suggest you go Google it because it's hilarious looking.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because I really thought that, you know, I thought I had actually a decent amount of games out for it, but really it didn't.
Again, the main thing that I think of with Master System in terms of, you know, the pre-Genesis, I mean, I guess it had like a weird second life. Post-Genesis, where it got like down ports and like some Sonic games,
yeah,
as a real entry level kind of console, or didn't it keep going and going in South America? Like, it was big in Brazil.
Yeah, it kept going until I think it was actually discontinued in like 1994.
But if you think of it as just a contemporary of the NES, the only thing I could think of it that had going for it is it had some arcade ports that were better or you couldn't get on NES. Like, it had a sort of passable version of R-Type.
Yeah.
For an 8-bit console, obviously the TurboGrafx version of R-Type pissed all over it. But
yeah, I guess it had, what, like the Alex Kidd games and that's it?
Yeah, pretty much. And, you know, just like a couple of, like Greg said, like a couple of the IRM games from back in the day.
You know, it had a couple of other bigger ports too, but they came like way, way after anything came out on the NES. Like generally, it's like if you had one and you were looking at the NES, it was just like, wow, I wish that game and that game and that game would come out for it. But they're all on the NES. So eventually, you know, I kind of broke down and picked up an NES and couldn't never look back. But, you know, it's just, it's interesting, you know, playing this, you know, I'm sure that this will be taken off the Windows Phone App Store in short order. But it is really good. It's really well done. But it kind of, it makes me think of like what kind of Nintendo could do on smartphones, because I really just don't know. I feel like it's kind of like money that Nintendo is just turning their back on. Even though they've sort of, I think they've backed themselves into a corner price-wise with all their VC games, because their VC games are usually, you know, more than a buck or two kind of thing. But I really just have to think, if they made some app like this where you could download games onto like your iPhone, but then also download them onto like your Wii U instead, something like that, and charge maybe like a buck or two a game, I just think they could make a heck of a lot of money. Because I think that this stuff is going to, I mean, you're going to find these kinds of programs on smartphones anyways. People are just going to make them. And I don't think Nintendo making an official app would really hinder any piracy. But I think a lot of people, just because they don't feel like jailbreaking their phone or something like that, they would actually pay money to have Nintendo games sitting on their smartphone.
The issue is just that it violates the fundamental tenet of their business model as it has stood for the entire time they've ever been in the video game industry, which is, you know, we sell hardware as a company. That's what we do. But yep. In order to sell people hardware, there has to be the expectation that you can only ever play Nintendo games on Nintendo platforms. And they never want to cross that line.
I don't know. These days, I just question the wisdom of that. I mean, I get that, and I can see where they're coming from.
See,
but
I would almost argue that they wouldn't want to put it on a phone, because even if that weren't an issue, it would undeniably degrade the experience. I mean, playing any NES game with virtual buttons is worse.
Absolutely.
Well, and I also question the idea that people want to play real games on their phones. And I don't mean that to sound bad, but the kinds of games that you play on your DS, I don't know that they want to play that on their phone, because Ghost Trick came out for iOS this week, and a lot of people are going crazy over it, which is, and I think it's cheap and it's very accessible. You get the first two chapters for free. I think it's great, and I think people should play Ghost Trick regardless. And I'm not saying this is a bad version, because Ghost Trick is, you can play it entirely with a touchscreen anyway on DS. I think the interface should be fine for it. But I thought about it, and I was like, you know, I don't know that I would want to play a 15-hour-long adventure game on my phone. And I don't think a lot of people do, even though you can, and it works perfectly fine. It's not even a culture thing. It's maybe an ergonomics thing. It's maybe a battery thing.
But, I mean, the thing is, a lot of these NES games, especially the earlier ones, they're perfect. I mean, they're pretty much what these cell phone games are aping.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
But then you run into the fundamental problem that James talked about, in terms of they were designed at the time, they were designed in a very uncharitable manner. You know, it's because they were aping arcade games, which were trying to just take your money, nickel and diming you.
I will take all of your cash. Yeah.
So that unforgiving quality transposes very badly to unreliable input mechanisms.
Or to non-input mechanisms.
Yeah, touchscreen is certainly not ideal. I mean, they would have to have a phone with much better input control, maybe
the
like
Xperia,
Xperia Play or something.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, they're going to put their games on the Sony PS phone.
Well, yeah, exactly. Something like that, but I mean, it's not...
The Sony PS phone / marketing disaster.
Okay, so I'll wrap up new business, and I'm going to be very quick. This week was mostly, I was very busy, but when I did get to play games, it was mostly maintenance on other games that I've already talked about. I'm trying to finish a few things. In fact, I'm trying to finish about 5 games all at once. So I'm hoping one of them is actually going to wrap up soon, and then maybe the rest will just kind of waterfall behind that, because right now it feels like I'm just sort of right in the middle of everything all at the same time, which is somewhat stressful for me. But the one new thing this week that I played is just a little bit of Art Academy First Semester, which is a DSiWare game that I got for free through Club Nintendo. So I didn't technically buy it. I just used my fake coins.
You exchanged a form of currency.
No, they have no monetary value.
So?
I exchanged loyalty points. It's an opportunity cost. I could have bought napkin holders with it from Club Nintendo.
I'm not going to count it. I'm going to say you already broke it.
I felt my coins were much better spent on this.
Spent. There we go. Bam!
Yes, but I could also spend my time with you, James, bickering over semantics. Art Academy is, you know...
Why don't we do this show again?
The DSiWare game came out a couple years ago. It's kind of funny to be playing it on 3DS because the interface is totally tuned to DSi. Like, there's a thing that says, go back to the DSi menu. And, of course, I've never owned a DSi, so this means nothing to me. If I had owned a DSi when this came out, I probably would have bought it because it was cheap. And I am, let's just say, artistically challenged. So the idea of a very affordable, easy-to-use piece of software that could teach me how to sketch, you know, how to do some simple kinds of drawings and colorings, to me is very appealing. I don't know that this software is going to do it, and not because it's poorly done. So far, I've spent maybe an hour with it, and so far it seems like it's very gentle. It teaches you sort of the basic concepts of art, you know, of graphic design, of shadowing and where the lighting goes and mixing colors and, you know, how to bring things and make them feel like they're more in the foreground, even though it's totally a 2D game. What concerns me is just, it's just a technological limitation. It's that the touchscreen for DS, I don't think is particularly well suited for an art program. For one thing, it's not that sensitive because you do have to use a stylus and you do have to apply some pressure in order to get that stylus to register on the screen. But also, it's not actually pressure sensitive. I mean, it's either on or off. Either you're drawing on it or you are not. So in that sense, it's a lot different than, say, a Wacom tablet for your computer, which Mike Krahulik uses for Penny Arcade to draw on through his computer, and it's very sensitive and it's pressure sensitive. So when he's using a stylus to as a stand-in for a paintbrush, the harder he presses it, the thicker that paint goes on to his digital image. And you cannot do that with a DS touchscreen. It's just not that sophisticated. So what they end up doing is mocking it up in various ways. So for instance, if you're using a paintbrush, the longer your stroke is, the more faint it will become towards the end of the stroke. And what this does is, if you're just kind of messing around and, you know, slapping some lines down on the screen and trying to do something very quickly, it looks like you spent a lot more time putting nuance into it than you actually did. So it has the weird effect of actually making your paintings look nicer than they probably should. But I can see in the future that being a real problem. If you really are trying to do something very detailed on this interface, that kind of stuff is probably going to piss you off more often than not, because the game is sort of throwing in a little bit of spin for you. And so if you want to make it really do what you want and be very exact about what you're putting on the screen, I have a feeling that's going to be difficult to do because of all the fudge factors that they've thrown in here to make it easier to get into. For me, it's fine because it sort of boosts my confidence level when I see that it looks like there's a little bit of subtlety in the way the strokes are in the image, even though I have none naturally. And it is primarily lesson-based, and I think that's also a really good choice, because to put a true, like, art editor, like just a graphical editor on DS doesn't make much sense, because there's no way for you to print this stuff out. There's no way to post it to the internet. There's really not a good way for you to share it with anyone else. So it doesn't even make sense to spend hours and hours drawing something very meticulous on your DS, because then there's nothing you can do with it. It just lives there. I mean, it's stuck in your DS. There's no way to export it out to anything else and to share your creation with other people. So to me, it makes a lot more sense to use this as a tool to teach you techniques that you can then transfer to using pen and paper, or, you know, a better program on your computer or whatever. So I think that's a good approach to take. And hell, you know, the thing was free. It cost me 150 coins, whatever that means. So that's 10 minutes of filling out surveys. So I'm pretty pleased with it, and it's something I'll probably tinker around with over a very long period of time. All right, well, that's all for this week's new business. So we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we've got your listener mail. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
We begin this week with a review by Zachary Miller for Resident Evil Revelations, in which I'm disappointed to tell you that your Italian sidekick at no point shouts at you, "Get back on board, for fuck's sake!"
That joke is insensitive. People have died.
And next we have impressions from the Japanese 3DS eShop, funnily enough, with a title like this, Denpa Ningen no RPG by Danny Bivens.
Should be called Yes RPG.
Flying radio wave humans live inside of your 3DS, courtesy of this game by the people that normally do Pokemon spin-offs.
I am horrified and horrified by both parts of that sentence.
All right, and Zach Miller gives us an extra life column looking at Darkwing Duck on the NES, and he says, "Let's get dangerous."
Stop.
And on the Stop BC it. Recommendations front, Carmine Kai Red makes a cameo appearance, and he gives us the GBA Ambassador Games Edition, and he says that 3DS Ambassadors got 10 free GBA games from Nintendo, but are they all worth recommending? Are they, Kai? Are they?
Nate Andrews has an interview with Grant Davies of Endgame about their 3DS game Fractured Soul, and he asks about how this long-lost DS game is being remade on the 3DS. We also have a feature, the March 2 E3 2012 January edition, written by our own site director Neil Ronahan, in which he discusses the latest news and rumors on the Wii U.
I'm confused. Is that about March or January? So we've also got a blog called What I Played in January 2012 by Neil Ronahan, who really likes features with the word January in the title. Neil says, "I've got ambitious plans that will probably not be finished." I'm sure you can relate, John.
I know the feeling. What I played in the past 10 years by John Lindemann. I've got ambitious plans that will probably not be finished.
Probably.
Yeah, no, Neil plays a lot of games, so there's some meat to that blog post. And we have another blog by Josh Max called Why Do You Play Pokemon? In which members of the NWR staff talk about why they love catching them all.
Present company not included.
I like buying them all.
And, of course, you can check out all of this great original content as well as the latest news, screenshots, game profiles, release dates, podcasts.
Videos, son.
Man, hella videos. You name it, it's all over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back to the show, everyone. You know, every now and then we like to pull a few emails out of the bag, read them here on the show, and talk about the topics that you want us to talk about. And we've got some doozies today, so believe James has the first letter.
Tanuki141 writes, "What do you think the chances that Nintendo will let you transfer WiiWare and VC games to the Wii U? I hope this is guaranteed, but I never can foresee the insane things that Nintendo will do. Also, what do you think of Nintendo releasing Punch-Out for the Japanese eShop? I personally would rather have them keep the handheld games or the 3DS and console games on the Wii/Wii U and focus on bringing out more Game Boy and Game Boy Color games."
I completely agree with that sentiment. I'm not really interested in buying NES games on the eShop, and I'm not opposed to them being available if we live in the perfect world where they don't actually take up oxygen from the handheld games that could also be released at the same time. But in practice, Nintendo does not like to release, at least in the West, they don't like to release multiple virtual console games in the same week.
Even in Japan, though, I don't think you've had the same week where you would have a Game Boy game on 3DS coming out alongside one of the NES games that's also coming out of 3DS. So it's no doubt that the way Nintendo do things, it would be kind of crowding Game Boy games out.
Yeah.
Which it seems very curious when there's an awfully deep Game Boy and Game Boy Color library there. They've also signed up Turbo Express and Game Gear stuff.
For some stupid reason.
The first couple of Game Gear games have been rated by the ESRB. There's that could be in the pipeline. It just seems like
just Game Boy Color, Game Boy Advance stuff at some point in the future. And I would Virtual Boy, I would much prefer that they focused on that stuff.
Yeah, but that you can't straight emulate that. That's craziness. I mean, that would be like they did with the 3D classics.
Yeah, 3D remake.
Yeah, well, yeah, there aren't that many Virtual Boy games worth playing. So I think it's worth remaking the ones that are worth playing.
No, I mean, I would have rather seen them do Punch-Out as a 3D classics. I mean, that game would be great at it. I mean, we know that because I've played Teleroboxer.
Well, isn't that a lot more down the ring level, though?
Yeah, it is.
More like the arcade Punch-Out, where you had like the transparent boxer and all, because they couldn't do a transparent Mac, you know, that you've got that weird kind of three-quarter view of it. Right. And obviously he's really tiny.
Yeah, he is very small. Oh, yeah, it's like the arcade version. But still, I mean, it would certainly be better than an NES virtual console game.
Well, for some people, I could see why, you know, it's cool to have, just through the ambassador games and stuff, there's some sorts of games especially that are just more convenient to play. You know, I'm kind of in favor of it in an absolute sense. But as Johnny says, if we're dealing as we are in the real world with this sort of rivalry, with this crowding out issue, then, you know, I would rather have other things that haven't already been re-released digitally take priority.
Yeah.
Right.
Punch-Out is not hard to get. Okay. So, and it's a great game, and I'm sure if they bring Punch-Out to the West, which they will eventually, it will sell pretty good compared to some of these obscure, you know, today they released Maru's Mission for Game Boy on the eShop. I've never even heard of this game. It might be good, it might be terrible. I don't know the first thing about it. And I bet what they're seeing is that some of these Game Boy games aren't selling that well because they're just not as well known and they're from really a different era and they don't have the mind share that they're used to with virtual console releases. And, you know, for this early in the life, I mean, frankly, I think the virtual console support on 3DS has been pretty anemic so far. And maybe that's because they've put so much effort into the ambassador program. You know, maybe that soaked up all their resources in terms of getting stuff ready and putting it out there. And maybe they feel like, you know, the people who are most likely to buy virtual console games are probably the early adopters, the really hardcore fans anyway, who were part of the ambassador program.
Who now have 20 free games sitting on their 3DS.
Right. Maybe they feel like people just already have too much stuff, and so maybe they need to wait a while before they really open the floodgates with Virtual Console. But, I mean, just our experience with the Wii Virtual Console has me pretty pessimistic about the way that the 3DS one's going to be handled. But keep in mind, we're also in this limbo between the Wii Virtual Console really tapering out and the Wii U launching. And I do think there will be some kind of renaissance of Virtual Console when the Wii U launches, and maybe that will be reflected in 3DS as well.
But does the idea of a sort of revival of the whole Virtual Console concept on Wii U, is that compatible with being able to transfer all your games over or not?
I would read it the other way around, of the fact that a revival would be required is sort of telling. I mean, because you would think if they were going to just directly move the service over, they would have continued to put content into it, because ultimately that content is still content. And then they'd be launching the Wii U with more content rather than less. But the fact that they've basically said, yeah, we're kind of done, although Europe got more virtual console games the last 2 weeks, so that's confusing.
Yeah. And Japan still gets 3 or 4 months. I mean,
it does feel very different than its comparable thing, which I'm sure people who are going to take the opposite position from me will bring up, that the DSiWare. But the DSiWare was picking up when the 3DS came out. I mean, it was really just finding its groove.
There's a lot of different ways you could look at it, but in terms of what this means about transferability, I mean, one thing I would feel confident of is that because of the way it's been done in the past, you're not going to be able to kind of have it on your Wii U and your old Wii. I would have thought if they're going to have it at all, it will just be a case of, you know, a one-time transfer from the one system to the other, and then that is it. It's done.
Yep.
But I would be perfectly fine with that, and I think they will do that.
I don't, because I've seen this game and I don't like where it's going. I mean, even WiiWare is pretty much not, Nintendo isn't even talking about it right now. I mean, we'll have WiiWare come out and it'll be in the press release, but it'll be like buried in the bottom, like, hey, well, another Carmen Sandiego math game came out.
WiiWare is fundamentally broken, and I think the interest of developers in releasing good games on WiiWare has drastically dropped off once they saw the reality of that marketplace and the development costs and the possible return. And
if Nintendo was telling them, hey, your stuff is going to be on the Wii U as well, you would think there'd be some developers going, okay, I'm game, I'll keep making stuff. But no, we're just getting...
Or they could just wait until Wii U comes out when people are actually looking for that stuff.
Well, but it's still something of a separate matter as well, in terms of, you know, we're talking about things that have already been sold and how Nintendo treats that. You know, I mean, the core question is, are they going to try and essentially cheap out on this at the risk of annoying some of their more ardent customers, right? Simply because they think ultimately people will put up with it and they might actually rebuy stuff.
It's very likely that there are considerations in play with the contracts they signed with
publishers. Keep in mind, when the DSiWare launched, the 3DS was already in development. Nintendo knew it was going to what was going to be the future of that system. When these contracts to make WiiWare and Virtual Console releases were signed, Wii U didn't exist. I mean, it was years and years and years down the road. When DSiWare launched, 3DS was like a year down the road.
3DS came out 2 years after DSi, James.
But not 2 years after DSiWare launched.
Okay, when did DSiWare launch?
After the DSi.
Well, the eShop launched after the 3DS.
Yeah, but we knew it existed. I mean, there is a bigger gap between Wii U and WiiWare than DSiWare and 3DS.
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, factually, that is obviously the case, but...
My feeling is that they will, to some extent, they will try and get people to rebuy selected titles again, because they've done it with 3D classics, you know, on 3DS. But, you know, they will offer some sort of enhanced functionality with it rather than just like, well, you know, rebuy it because it's on a different piece of hardware and you want to do it for convenience. They might actually maybe add some features, you know, to a multiplayer game. You might actually add online play or like leaderboards, or if it's a high school game or this kind of thing, maybe something that fits in with the tablet controller somehow. You know, I don't think they're just going to say, well, we'll take the easy way out and so let's make everybody re-download the games just, you know, because we think we can make money that way. I think they'll try and do something a little more to get people to buy a new version of something that they've already bought many times, even if it's only a little different.
Right. I mean,
and I don't know what... I mean this seriously. I don't know what moving a game developed for the Wii to the Wii U would entail. I mean, there could very well be some weirdness in play. I realize that it's backwards compatible with Wii disc games, but what if there's games that use like some weird controller configuration with the GameCube controllers or whatever? I mean, we don't know.
It may not be fully... I mean, it may not... You know, there may be certain exceptions, but I think by and large, they're going to have to make this work because this is the standard in the marketplace right now.
By what standard? I mean, by who?
Well, they already established it with the 3DS to some extent, and that's...
They've done it with 3DS. I mean, imagine if you bought the new iPhone and all the apps and music and videos and everything else that you bought for your old one didn't work on the new iPhone. People would flip their shit. That is the standard of the day, and it's also going to be the standard with PlayStation and Xbox.
Yep.
There's a very quick way to kill that standard. Oh, it's not backwards compatible. Sorry.
It's going to have to be.
I don't think it does, actually. I honestly don't believe that.
I think if your Xbox Live arcade games don't work on the new Xbox, people are going to flip out.
For like a week, and then they'll forget, like they did when Microsoft stopped supporting backwards compatibility in the Xbox.
But the difference is, for those, you have to actually go get the old disc and put it in there. When you buy a new PC, your Steam account moves over and you get to play all the games that you bought and played on your previous PC. So the idea that these licenses are tied to specific hardware systems, I just don't buy it. I think they're tied to a end user license agreement that you agree to with the platform holder, and that will be compatible with the new system because it has to be.
Look, I'm stating right now, I don't think it's going to be that clean.
Well, I'm not saying it's easy. I'm saying it's mandatory.
No, I'm not saying talking about easiness. I'm saying I legitimately believe there will be a wide swath of games that are not compatible with the Wii U.
I mean, all the PSP games you can download off of PSN, you can download onto the PS Vita. So,
I mean, the point is, for me, the standard of the industry is clear that, you know, this is the sort of thing that should happen. And to some extent, Nintendo's most recently established standard comports with that. Mm-hmm. The only reason why we're even having this conversation is just that sometimes, you know, Nintendo is a bit contrarian in this regard. And obviously there is no account with Wii. There's no already existing account that just transfers to another system. So it's a definitely a legitimate conversation to have. And as I don't think you can hope for just re-downloading it on your Wii U. Yeah, you know, it's going to be a one-time transfer. But, you know, I think even if it might end up being partial or that, this, that, and the other, it's probable that it will happen. But I'll concede not entirely certain, because you never know if there's just some little kink in the works. Going back to 2006, you do have to wonder how much they anticipated some of these things at the very fundamental level. So I think it's fair enough to concede some doubt, but I would still deem it probable.
I think they'll do it on the web. Personally, I think they'll have you
sign in. Shut up. That's not even possible.
I'm telling you.
John, we are not talking about the same company. Stop talking.
The eShop's going to be on the web, so John is barking up the right tree.
It's going to happen. If you don't have an account on, you know, Club Nintendo, they will have you create one, and then it will grab all your game info off your Wii, and you'll just be able to transfer over, something like that. It'll be something like that.
There's no way it'll work that cleanly, and you know it.
All right, let's move on to the next email, please, Greg.
Denna writes, long-time listener, first-time writing. You guys bring up the Dragon Quest franchise a lot. Sadly, I have never played a Dragon Quest game, though I'd love to try one out. If I were to start the series fresh, what game should I start with?
Swords.
Dragon Quest Monsters Joker.
There we go.
John, what do you really think? Because you're the other big fan of the series here.
That's the thing. I mean, really, it's how much you can tolerate the really old school Dragon Quest games, I would say.
I wouldn't advise that to be the starting point.
Probably Dragon Quest IX, to be honest with you. I mean,
I feel like IX is a little too sprawling for its own good for a first-time player. I would go with, if you can handle playing a really long RPG on a console, I'd go with 8. Which is a PlayStation 2 game, which I don't know if you have access to, and that's the only version currently, but it is probably my favorite of the whole series, and it's very accessible, and it's really good. It has very good voice acting. It's really beautiful, very easy game to get into. I recommended it very highly to TYP, and he tried it out, and he loved it, and he ended up playing other Dragon Quest games after that. So for him, it was a good entry point. So that's my basis for that.
How do you think it compares to 9? I mean, 9 has all the nice little things like, you know, it tells you where you are in the story, so you don't really get lost if you put the game down for a little while. Like, how does 8 compare to that? I've played some of 8, but...
I don't think it has that particular feature, but...
Which is important for John Lindemann.
Overall, the games are, you know, from only a few years apart, and in some ways, 8 is... I think the presentation is so much better, the interface is maybe a little better, and 8 doesn't have as much stuff about... picking up random party members, and you don't have to create your own character.
Yeah.
I don't know. To me, 8 is a more pure Dragon Quest game. 9 is definitely...
Yeah, it's probably more straightforward, definitely.
Yeah, 9 is an evolution of the series, which was controversial, you know, and I'm not opposed to that, but I feel like some of the changes they made in 9, I didn't care for. I'm not opposed to the idea of change. I just want them to be good changes. And 9 was a little bit mixed on that point. It's still a great game, but 8 is still my favorite of those two. And then outside of that, I think Dragon Quest IV on the DS is my favorite of the DS remakes. It's portable. It's very cheap and easy to get. It has a really cool story. It's called Chapters of the Chosen. It's divided up, and you sort of, the first 5 chapters, you're playing as a different character each one. So it's kind of broken up into chunks, which is maybe a little more accessible way to get into something. You know, you kind of experience different gameplay styles over that period, and then they all come together for the final chapter, which is much longer than the rest of them. And that, to me, that game is just really cool, and I don't know of any other RPG like it, including any other Dragon Quest game. So I always recommend Dragon Quest IV to everybody. The DS version is great. It looks really good. It has a cool 3D camera and everything, and it's just an excellent game. So that would be my other recommendation, either 4 or 8.
I would not disagree.
James, have you played really any of these? I mean, do you really have a...
I'm not particularly passionate about the series, to be honest.
But have you played any?
Some. I've played some of the early NES games. It's just not... It was never a series that really caught on for me.
Okay. And Greg, have you jumped into Dragon Quest ever?
No, I've never played one, so I'm somewhat in the same position. But I mean, I'm not burning to go and play one. There's always probably a few other RPGs that are seemingly at least more interesting that are also on the sort of queue of ones to try out. There's the reprint of Radiant Historia coming in March. I think that looks pretty definite now. I've already seen one of the retailers that provide, you know, import service to Europe has already got it for pre-order in March.
I do want to say that if you're a fan of Chrono Trigger, you know, there's a lot of Dragon Quest DNA in Chrono Trigger. So I definitely think it's worth checking out. There's if you like Chrono Trigger, you could probably find a Dragon Quest game you would like. In fact, you'd probably like most of them because they're all very similar to each other.
I would still say the older ones, though, are very, very, very rough by modern standards.
One through three are all very difficult. Yeah. The fourth one, especially on the DS, they toned down the difficulty a lot.
I would say even its contemporary Final Fantasy games, so the ones that are contemporaneous to those three games, are considerably more approachable now by modern standards than the Dragon Quest games are.
Okay, John has the next letter.
All right, James writes, so I enjoyed your discussion of Panzer Dragoon Saga on the most recent RFN. I am a huge fan of the series, and that game in particular is, in my opinion, the best game ever made. I have noticed that recently I've lost a lot of my appetite for playing games. There are many causes, being older, life stuff, the decreasing quality and bro-ness of games, etc. I realized while listening to your show, part of it was having finally played Panzer Dragoon Saga last year. The game was so good, so satisfying, that it changed my attitude towards gaming in general. Have you ever played a game that was so good that it made other games dissatisfying to you? I think Panzer Dragoon Saga and the experience I had there was so good, it just increased the standard so much for what I want in a game that I just don't find that much joy in new games that a few years ago I would have loved.
Everyone say it together, World of Warcraft for John Lindemann.
Probably.
But it seems to be a distinction here between simply something taking up your time and therefore decreasing your ability to play other kinds of games, and actually somehow changing your perceptions and your standards and your tastes even to some extent, to a point where you don't really want to play them other games or anymore, regardless of how much time you would have to
right.
actually
well,
do
Well,
that,
that's the thing, right? That's why I think it kind of really turned me off to games like Skyrim, because to me, at least with something like WoW, I have the option of playing that kind of game. Because, I mean, I play Skyrim, and it's just, you know, quests, right? You go get a quest, you go complete it, bring it back, do this, do that. And to only have the option of doing that by yourself seems kind of archaic to me. Like, I can't get into it when I could go play an MMO and have the option of playing with other people. You know, I can play it like I would play a game like Skyrim, but also, on the other hand, I also have the option of, you know, doing raids or whatever you want, five-man, you know, content, stuff like that, like instance content. You know, I could do PvP if I want. There's, like, a lot of other things there that you can do. And Skyrim just kind of locks you into one style of gameplay.
Do you also find that not paying $15 a month is archaic? I have a counterexample, so maybe you guys should go first if you have anything you can think of.
Yeah, that's the thing. The idea, basically, of what I'm getting from this letter from James here is he's had a glimpse of a way maybe that gaming was to some extent with the Panzer Dragoon Saga, and therefore it's just made the way games currently are all the more bitter for him. You know, and I don't really have that because obviously I play a lot of old games, and you know, that really started with the Wii Virtual Console. There was probably a sort of a low ebb towards the end of the GameCube's life, where I didn't necessarily play that many games. And I think, you know, some of the retro style games on DS, and even going back to some ones that were on GBA once I had a handheld with a visible screen because I didn't get an SP, all that kind of stuff, it just, if anything, the older games actually rekindled my interest in gaming in general, and you know, it's gone from there. Now, that doesn't mean I've been queuing up to buy Modern Warfare or Gears of War, but I think there's plenty of new games here, you know, that's coming out of the industry that serve the kinds of person that enjoys the classic action games very well. You know, I think obviously Mario games still do that very well. In some cases, some people would say probably a bit too closely even. Yeah. There's plenty of examples of games like Hatsworth or that are completely new that trade off it. I don't find that it's just soured me at all.
Yeah, I don't find that games replace games for me. Just because a new game comes out, it doesn't mean I don't like this game over here.
Right, right.
I've found in localized instances where a specific game at a moment of time decreases my ability to enjoy comparable titles that would otherwise be regarded as high quality events. For me, going back, I played this game later than it came out, although not much later. But I actually played through Lufia 2 on the Super Nintendo. I absolutely adore that game. I mean, it's a phenomenal title, and I actually found that I was less forgiving of other Super Nintendo RPGs after I played that game than I probably was before, simply because I enjoyed it so much. I actually found playing I deliberately played Lufia 2 before Lufia 1 because it's a prequel. And found that was the biggest mistake I could have ever made. Because
yeah,
Lufia,
that was a big mistake.
Lufia 1 only came out a year earlier. And is a good game. But its sequel is so much better in everything. I mean, literally, I have never heard of a game that is so much better 1 year later.
Well, I think how long you've been playing games also factors into it. Because after a while, you start to realize, you know, the patterns that exist among different types of games. You know what I mean? So it's like you just kind of get like, oh, here we go again sort of thing.
I mean, I have been playing games for at least 14, 15 years at that point. I mean, I certainly had chops.
And if anything, I think this email piques my interest even more in Panzer Dragoon Saga because this person never played it until a year ago, and now it's his favorite game of all time. I mean, and that...
Yeah,
and that game is 10 years old, oh, more than 10 years old.
Oh, no, it's older than that. It's
yeah, maybe
like
almost
15.
So that really probably gives you an idea of just how good it is. It's an RPG in which you ride around on a dragon and shoot things with lasers. That sounds pretty appealing to me. I don't know about you
I'm
guys.
I'm intrigued by that for sure.
And all yeah. And everything's made of squares.
On a more recent note, I had a similar experience with Radiant Historia, although there weren't many games that it, in terms of localized siblings, had a chance to shit upon, because there weren't many DSRPGs in that particular era. And in fact, there weren't many RPGs I played in general until I got my hands on Xenoblade, which in and of its own right is a very, very good game. But if there had been other DSRPGs that came out around the time of Radiant Historia, I probably wouldn't want to have played them. I feel like I would have been at a point where I was not just contented with the genre, but would have felt like, I'm not sure I'm really going to enjoy this.
Yeah, I mean, that's just like a kind of cyclical appetite kind of thing. I mean, I've talked about it with respect to Xenoblade and Last Story, even though they are quite different. But, you know, there's a sort of recharge, maybe like a cool-off period. And the thing is, it's exacerbated if then the other game wouldn't be as high a standard.
Right.
If your kind of appetite for it's sort of muted already, and then it's put in a sort of unfavorable context, I can understand that.
Yeah, I certainly could not have reviewed another DSRPG back to back with that game. I would it would not have been fair to the game I was reviewing.
But what James is talking about in the email here is
the other James
is very much the opposite sort of thing. Is actually, you know, it's really sharpened his disdain for things that are not at all like Panzer Dragoon.
Yeah, and I don't necessarily have a strong example to that. I mean, I played the Sakura Wars game, which isn't a great game, but it does do some interesting story development mechanics, which when I was done with that game, I was kind of done playing games for a little bit because I shot through the various story branches quickly because I just enjoyed seeing what decisions did. But I had that experience this week when I tried to just play more of L.A. Noire when I realized, well, my decisions don't make any difference. It's like I can get every question wrong and I still catch the perp.
Yeah.
And I felt like that was really, I mean, upsetting. I mean, in my mind, I was comparing it to games like Sakura Wars game where my decisions made a difference.
You're probably the first person to ever compare L.A. Noire to Sakura Wars.
Probably. But I compared it to other games too. Like I did the Mass Effect games. I had some other games in my head as I was going through. For me, it sort of shattered my immersion in the game every time I'd get something wrong. And then as I walked away, my partner would instantly go, oh yeah, he was lying. We should go to there instead. It's like,
again, though, it's the issue of, you know, this is trying to do something which you've seen done, you know, maybe more effectively elsewhere. Whereas I feel like the email's talking about is see things done to some extent that just aren't done much anymore. But in some ways, what I find that's hard to kind of imagine about that is that, you know, games have grown an awful lot. And while there are certain values that have become more stressed in the industry now compared to the old days, you know, like storytelling in some aspects, or, you know, online components and multiplayer and all this kind of stuff. I mean, there's a lot of things that have crept in and that are a lot more prevalent now that maybe some people just don't care for. But I still feel like the industry caters pretty well to people if you have, you know, an old school sensibility in various ways. you know, whether it's stuff that's beyond XBLA, PSN, virtual console stuff, or I mean, there still feels like there's a lot of games you could be playing, but it's kind of difficult to know specifically when I'm not, having never played Panzer Dragoon Saga, I'm not sure what about that game.
Well, I mean, you should just go buy it then. I'm sure it's affordable.
What is especially sort of unique?
Yeah, I don't know. I could see it with that kind of RPG. Right? Because I don't think those kinds of RPGs are really being made in great numbers anymore.
Well, obviously, I mean, we've talked plenty of times about the way the console RPG has sort of died a bit of a death here over the last so many years. But, I mean, you still do have portable RPGs that are very good. And
absolutely.
There's still rare examples like Xenoblade. They do exist, but again, I'm not sure that they necessarily do what Panzer Dragoon does.
I wonder if Xenoblade might actually be a really good choice for James, the writer here, to maybe capture some of what you liked about Panzer Dragoon Saga. It's hard to understand without knowing the specifics of what you liked about that particular game, and it's a game that none of us are really familiar with. But I have to say, we're not
crazy enough to buy it.
I don't think this phenomenon could ever happen to me, because I just don't. It's just that my personality wouldn't lend me to take this kind of a sour view on things, but I've actually have a counterexample of the complete opposite happening to me, which is, and I think I've described this before, but there was a period in the mid-90s where maybe for a year and a half, 2 years, I wasn't as interested in video games as I had been earlier in life. And sort of the late Super Nintendo era, the early PlayStation 1 era, I just wasn't really impressed by what was coming out, and nothing really captured my interest very much. And to this day, there is kind of a gap in my history. There's a number of games that came out during that period that I've still never played and don't really care to. And the game that rekindled me was Super Mario 64. And I really knew very little about it, saw it running in the demo in the electronics boutique at the mall, and found out that they were selling in 64s 3 days early, and walked home with one that day. And from there on, within a couple of years, I was on the internet and was starting my own website about Nintendo. So that really launched me in the whole other direction, which is I thought Super Mario 64 was so amazing and so mind-shattering and so revolutionary that it made me want to play video games, period. And, I mean, just to give you an example, the next game I played after that was Cruisin' USA, which is a shit
game. Oh, God.
And I played a lot of it, and I didn't care that it sucked because I was happy to be playing video games again.
Apologize to the listeners for reminding them that's a game.
Yeah, I owned it. I asked for it for Christmas and got it.
Well, yeah, that was. But see, the listeners had no warning you were going to bring up that.
So Super Mario 64 is actually so good that it made me love playing video games almost regardless of what they were or how good they were after that. So I think it can happen the opposite way, too. But interesting little story for sure. Now we're going to move on. And the next email is from Caesar in Australia. He says, I'd like to hear the whole crew's reactions to the recent release of Hyrule Historia, a Japan-only Zelda art book brought out as part of the Zelda 25th Anniversary Collection. Among other things, it revealed a great deal of hitherto unknown details on the development of and background to the Zelda games, including the official timeline. As far as I'm aware, there's never been anything similar from Nintendo released, and certainly not with this kind of scope, notwithstanding the Mario Collection's art book, quote, art book. Is this a sign of things to come for other series, or is this just a one-off? Could this book or others like it ever see a release outside of Japan?
Can I say something first?
Please.
Discussions of the Zelda timeline make me want to kill myself.
Yeah, let's not actually get into the timeline itself.
Like right now,
I'm not interested in that at all.
But, I mean, it's not just that I don't care about the timeline. It's what the conversations that come with it amongst...
Yeah, the timeline does bad things to people. It really does. It's the green orb in heavy metal.
There's no sense in getting too deeply involved with something that is fundamentally ad hoc in nature.
Yeah, it's never meant to be along a timeline. So
it's inherently retconned.
In a few years, this Hyrule Historia will itself be outdated, I assure you of that. So, we won't talk about that. Now, in terms of just the idea of having this kind of supplementary material available as a standalone kind of product, it's not something they're going to do very often. I mean, clearly, the Zelda 25th anniversary is a very unique occasion in the way they celebrated it. You know, Mario did not get the same treatment, and other stuff, like like Metroid or whatever has not gotten nearly the same treatment. So I think this is pretty much a one-off.
Yeah.
And there's not that many other games that would have the kind of depth of material that a Zelda game would. You know, the amount of character designs or the amount of lore or...
And considering how many games there are, just in terms of insights from the various development cycles that they could, they could call... I mean... There's so many events, Zelda events, that they could pull from. I would also point out that I doubt that this really made Nintendo very much money. I mean, books as a rule are not especially profitable expenditures, especially these limited release ones.
It was essentially commemorative. I mean, that's the point of it.
This was Nintendo's gift to both the fans and the series more than anything. I mean,
I wish we lived in a world where this could be brought to America and be given out as like a Club Nintendo Platinum reward, because that, to me, that is exactly the kind of stuff they should do for the Platinum reward, and it's the kind of thing, if you are a Platinum Club Nintendo member, that's the kind of thing that you would actually appreciate, whereas the average Joe would not, but they would just take such a bath on the cost to print it and localize it and ship it out.
And honestly, it wouldn't surprise me in the least to hear that they lost money on it in Japan, even though it sold out almost instantly.
Yeah, it's the kind of item it's not meant to make money.
That in itself demonstrates it's a one-off. You don't make a regular thing
of losing money unless you're Sony.
I would love to flip through a copy of it, though, I'll tell you that.
I think for them, they'll regard it as a good PR coup, and it was a nice get for them. It got them some nice coverage. You know, in the time Skyward Sword, after it's come out and it's sort of gone through its initial sales, they can get Zelda back in the headlines. You know, there's some play there for Nintendo, too. I mean, they got some plus out of this that's not immediately recognizable in terms of cost versus return. But ultimately, I just don't know what series they would do this for if they haven't done it already.
Metroid would be worth doing, but it just doesn't have the fan base to support something like this.
No, I mean, really...
I think it has the content.
Really, the only candidate in Nintendo's arsenal that I see is Pokemon. I mean, they could do an art book of Sugimori's drawings. I mean, they could certainly give some discussion on the various Pokemon they've rejected.
There's almost too much content with Pokemon.
I mean, there is a fan base who's more than willing to eat that up. However, there's like 800 Pokemon books at this point. I mean,
they could do it a lot cheaper and probably sell a lot more.
I'm sure there are. I mean, there's a freaking Pokemon theme park in Japan. I'm sure there are art books that you can get if you go there.
Yeah, but they probably come out of the Pokemon company instead of out of Nintendo.
Yeah, that's the thing. They've got the whole separate licensing company that just...
There's a Pokemon TV show.
Yeah.
Not the anime. There is a TV show about Pokemon in Japan.
Pokemon Korokoro, yes. It is a talk show. It has hosts.
Yeah, it's a totally different cultural tier.
They discuss Pokemon news, and then they are occasionally molested by guys in Pokemon costumes.
Yeah, and over here, I used to get excited when CNN actually mentioned Nintendo in the ticker at the bottom of the screen.
By the way, if you ever get a chance to watch an episode of that show on YouTube, oh my god, you should. It's absolutely absurd.
So, James has the final email this week.
Hiawatha writes, I noticed that Rayman Origins has been receiving great reviews across the board, with praise for being, quote, unique, artistic, and bucking trends of the day from IGN. However, we have actually seen all of these attributes in various Wii games from the past few years, but they were treated very differently by the critics. For instance, IGN described Wario Land Shake It as, quote, a traditional 2D platformer that, quote, isn't very innovative. Similarly, Kirby's Epic Yarn, quote, a lot of Kirby's gameplay is by-the-book platforming that will immediately be familiar to anyone who has picked up a video game in the last 20 years. I believe Rayman Origins is so highly regarded above Nintendo's platformer simply because it's a multi-console release. Perhaps Rayman Origins is being embraced as a symbol for the HD system owners that they do not need Nintendo's platform because the third-party one isn't merely good, but actually better than Nintendo's offerings. How could Wario, Mario, two Kirbys, and Donkey Kong all pale in comparison to Rayman? Aren't Wario Land Shake It and Kirby's Epic Yarn unique and artistic with their hand-drawn and fabric-crafted graphics? Didn't New Super Mario Bros. Wii buck the trends of the day when it debuted as a four-player 2D side-scroller in the first place?
Yeah, it's a really good point.
The love affair with Michel Ancel by members of the media is long and storied.
Yeah, that's probably a good point. I mean, Yes, I mean, Beyond Good and Evil was just critically lauded beyond belief, and it is a very good game. But considering how poorly it sold,
it only sold to the media.
And Rayman Origins, you know, I don't know how well it sold, but I don't think it was a big blockbuster, but certainly a lot of people played it.
It wasn't. It's already been discounted.
It's over here. It's got really cheap really quickly, and I will be picking it up.
I'm actually thinking about either the 3DS or the Vita version. If I do get a Vita, I know people complain that those versions don't have multiplayer, but this game is supposed to be so hard. I don't think I would want to play it multiplayer anyway.
Multiplayer is not a big deal for me either.
You look at the gorgeous 2D artwork, like that seems really well suited to that Vita OLED screen. So to me, this seems like the kind of thing I might actually want to play on that. On 3DS, it'll be, you know, not as high res, but the 3D effect could be appealing to some people too.
I would say that it's not so much console bias in play here. I mean, I would say that it's more platform ignorance.
Well, I mean, there is a potential, the one potential I considered for this, again, I mean, look, none of us have played Rayman Origins, so none of this is a commentary on how
But
good...
Johnny, you played it.
I played it at E3.
You played E3, but, you know, we've not seen the totality of it enough to you know, have a really solid opinion of how well it stacks up.
I review all my games based on E3 demos.
I have no doubt that it's fantastic, but then I like 2D platformers already, so I'm not surprised that I would enjoy it. What's interesting is it does seem to be embraced by a lot of people who don't normally spend much time talking about 2D platformers. I mean, on this podcast, we spend plenty of time talking about 2D platformers, but we're the exception. And, you know, I'm not really interested in comparing review quotes here because the reviews that Hiawatha brought up were written by IGN's Nintendo team, and they may well have different standards for platformers than other websites because they play more of them. So they may be more critical.
Well,
what
I was going to say about that is one potential route you could see is that you've got a situation where this is a multi-platform game, so you could get people coming in to play to review this game that normally wouldn't get to review that many 2D side-scrollers, whereas, especially when you consider the fact that in the past, you know, you've had the Nintendo team, so it's not just even Wii guys, but guys have been reviewing a lot of DS games as well, where 2D gameplay is obviously a lot more common than it is on the HD consoles. You know, they've definitely seen a lot of platformers recently. You know, they've been doing it. So the reason why Rayman might seem like a breath of fresh air, if it's been covered by a PlayStation or Xbox team guy on a multi-platform site.
Right. And that's what I meant when I said platform ignorance. Like, they are legitimately ignorant.
They're just not exposed. They're not exposed. They haven't been reviewing maybe a lot of these games. So that to them, it says, oh, this is, like you said, a breath of fresh air.
They literally do not know of these. I mean, they know they exist, but that's it. I mean...
But on the other hand, I've seen specifically Rayman Origins, you know, the Wii version has got good reviews from Nintendo dedicated websites like ourselves. So it's not as if, you know, it's only the people that have been sort of ignorant of the platforming revival that think this is a good game.
Right.
That should definitely be pointed out. So I could imagine, you know, that might kind of embellish this factor a little bit. But I mean, to be fair, it's something we used to talk about years ago. I mean, myself and Johnny and TYP even of the mind that Wario Land Shake It is underrated.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, if Shake It doesn't have a vaunted place in the zeitgeist of gaming media, that's because not nearly enough people played it because it was a Wii game. And it was a full-price Wii game. If you remember, that was a hot topic on this podcast before it came out was, should it be a WiiWare title? I mean, once you play it, I think you'll laugh at that idea. But at the time, we didn't know much about it. We hadn't really tried it ourselves. They hid it at E3. It was almost impossible to play it at E3. You had to have like a very specific access to a very exclusive part of Nintendo's booth in order to play it. And Nintendo did not do a good job promoting it. And that, you know, that's a story we could tell about a lot of games. But the fact is, I mean, the intrinsic quality of that game, I think it's, I'm sure it is just as good as Rayman Origins. And, you know, I bet if you talk to the people who made Rayman Origins at Ubisoft, they would probably bring up a lot of these games that Hiawatha mentions, you know, the Kirby's and the new Super Mario Brothers and the Wario Lands too. I'm sure they've played all these. Kirby's Epic Yarn. How could you not? If you're making a 2D platformer on a console...
Wasn't there an interview with Ansel where he would say he didn't play a lot of Mario or something, but I don't know how much that goes for the rest of his team or whatever. But, you know, at the end of the day, for me, I don't think there's any kind of systematic, coordinated bias going on here. There's a certain amount of organic quality to it because, maybe some people that are not been drowning in platformers the last few years. Like, to be fair, I mean, that has been what's been coming out for the Wii at this point, and a lot of them are really good. You know, I think DK is really good, and I enjoyed Epic Yarn and all that, but I can imagine, it is different for those people. But even just forgetting different teams, like for Xbox Sony or whatever, I mean, sites are not monoliths. At the end of the day, it's always an individual person reviewing.
Yeah, if it had been the same reviewer who wrote that quote, which I know it isn't, then you probably could have gone, well, wait, I have a question.
But that's not the way it is. You know, everyone in the end, they work for that site, but it's not a hive mind. You know, they bring their own perspective to it. They bring their own judgments to it. So this sort of consistency test is always a bit of a fool's errand for me. I don't think there's much to be gleaned from it. And then the other factor I would just say is that Wario Land was underrated. I think that's a legitimate point, but I don't think it's a question of it being underrated relative to other platformers specifically. It's just underrated in general.
Right.
That's how I feel about it. And I'm kind of at a bit of a loss to explain it, really. I mean, you could talk about the promotion and all this kind of stuff, but then when someone sits down and reviews the game, that shouldn't matter. You just play the game and you rate the experience you have with it. And still, 1UP was very tepid on it, IGN was warmer but not that hot. I mean, I just disagree with those reviews again. I mean,
it's the discussion of sites are not monoliths. I mean, we cover effectively three systems right now, two and a half, I mean, depending on how you want to look at it. And it's opinion. I mean, that's what reviews are. There's going to be a game. Everyone who reviews games regularly, and I mean, I only probably do 5, 6, 7 a year, and that's semi-regularly, so it's regularly enough for this point. Everybody who reviews games regularly will find a game at some point that does something for them that it won't do for 95% of the people in the world.
James, I love that you're sitting here defending the sanctity of an individual's opinion when you are famous for just saying that someone's opinion is factually wrong.
Well, wait, hold on. Let me finish.
How inconsistent can you be, sir?
There are reviews that can be literally just absurd. And they still exist. They are still the point of reference by which these scores are judged. And that may be my reaction when I read someone's review and go, wow, you're just way the hell off.
I mean, I think some of this question boils down to what you think reviews are for. I mean, from the point of view that, say, for instance, if we have a situation where an IGN type site has one of their PlayStation guys review Rayman Origins, even though he's not as well versed in the side-scrolling platformer as the guys would be from the Nintendo team or whatever, and he reviews it, and maybe it's somewhat, just for the sake of the argument, let's say it is somewhat inflated because it seems more innovative, it seems more fresh than perhaps it really is to that person. But at the same time, they're doing that from the perspective of kind of a PlayStation or Xbox owner. So, I mean, if you're one of those people that doesn't own a Wii or whatever, that's a perfectly valid type of opinion for them because you're going to get a sort of similar type experience. And on the flip side, if you're a Nintendo fan, that's why you could come to a website like ours, because it's all, we're reviewing games always from the perspective of Nintendo fans. Again, there's no guarantees because it's always one person that's doing the review, but chances are someone from our site, if they're reviewing Rayman, has played stuff like Kirby and DK and New Super Mario Brothers. And so you could get that kind of context if you're looking for, I would say
quite likely they've played Rayman as well. I mean,
sure.
That series has long roots on Nintendo platforms.
Exactly. But I mean, the point is that if you're looking for a recommendation, as to whether you should purchase it, I think both of those are fine, just depending on who you are. Now, if on the other hand, you're not looking at it from a point of view of, is it a recommendation? You're looking at it as a case of, okay, where do these things rank on the totem pole of what are the great games of our time? Well, then you might find the inconsistencies vexing.
Well, see, context is always important, right? Because there is a certain nameless reviewer who gave The Conduit an 8.5. At the time, though,
his name is John Lindemann,
it sparked a lot of controversy at the time. But that reviewer, I've talked to him several times, and he told me, I looked at it, this reviewer looked at it, and he said, based on what else is out for the Wii.
Are you talking in fourth person? What is going on here?
Based on what was out for the Wii at the time, he thought that that score made sense.
It was your gut feeling.
Well, not me, but you know, whatever.
Well, I feel like we might have gotten off track a little bit with that topic, but it is a good email, Hiawatha, and I think it's worth talking about. And it is interesting, when you review a game, your perspective on it really depends a lot on your background and your experiences. And I think this is a kind of a special case. You know, it's a genre that practically doesn't exist on these other platforms.
Well, especially retail, like, as well.
Right.
Because like, the thing is, sometimes, like, downloadable games, they might kind of have their own, like, mini team mm-hmm. on the site as well. So even though you might have some retro style, some 2D platformers out for XBLA, PSN, again, they might not be the same guys that are reviewing a retail release like Rayman. So it's kind of like this genre has kind of been partitioned into other places. And then this was a case where it released across all the platforms. And so maybe you did get a different perspective on it. But I don't think that's any less valid.
Different perspectives are healthy.
Yeah. And also, I mean, I would say just completing what we said before, Wario, I do feel like maybe did get some short shrift with certain sites.
Sure. And freaking Jungle Beat. I mean, Nintendo's 2D platformers have, I would say, consistently been sort of underrated over the years.
But I would say, I mean, look, you look at, I think the Epic Yarn reviews, the DK Return reviews, New Super Mario Bros. Wii, just going across the general swath, they're perfectly fair. I mean, I don't see them being sold short on, you know, well, they do this that's groundbreaking, or they do this that's clever or fresh, or are not getting credit for it, generally speaking. I mean, people love the Kirby's aesthetic. You know, I got loads of credit you know, when people are actually talking about that game specifically, rather than some person reviewing another game not referring back to it. I mean, that's the most important thing. I think they all got fair treatment when they were reviewed, and were roundly praised. They all got great reviews, as I recall.
Fair enough.
Wario Land, you know, I'm not saying that Wario Land got really unfairly treated away. I will just say they put on a gut level, there was more reviews of that than I sort of more strongly disagreed with.
Yeah. I mean, I think the implication that people like Rayman more because they feel that it frees them from having to play this kind of game on a Nintendo platform, I don't think people are doing that intentionally. I think there may be some deep down truth to that. I think people may feel that on an instinctual level, and they may be reflecting that in reviews without actually even realizing it. You know, I think for the same reason that John really enjoyed playing Conduit on Wii, and why a lot of people gave Conduit strong review scores and just strong recommendations, was, wow, you can finally play this kind of game on the Wii, right? It's really exactly the same thing here. It's people saying, wow, I can finally play a 2D platformer on my Xbox or PlayStation. And I can't really fault them for that. And obviously, it does lead to, in some cases, exaggerated opinions. But I think those exaggerated opinions come from people's joy. In some cases, people don't own a Wii, or they haven't felt compelled to play it in a long time. And so the idea of playing this on a system that is more accessible to them, that they're more comfortable playing with, they are very joyous about it. And I think that comes across in reviews, and that's fine.
I would say one thing. The comment that there wasn't much like it, if I had been the editor, I would have at least asked. I would have said, well, do you really mean that? I mean, there are a lot of examples of games like that. You could probably go insofar as say it's unique on this platform if you want.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, the idea of a four-player 2D platformer on a current generation console, when we play, the first thing I said was, oh, this is New Super Mario Bros. Wii. And it is. It is that. The art style is totally different. But I think the game plays very much like that, and that's fine. I'm glad that other people are also making those kinds of games. But, you know, if Michel Ancel claims that he has never heard of this Mario thing, what are you talking about? Clearly, that's bullshit. I think people should give credit where credit's due. That doesn't mean that Rayman isn't a great game. And I'm looking forward to playing it in the near future.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's going to have to wrap up the show. Thank you, everybody, for writing in. We had some really good emails. We had a lot more that we couldn't even get to this week. So the address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We'd love to hear from you. And if you can't remember that, maybe you're driving in the car when you listen to this.
Pull over.
You can always go to the show notes at NintendoWorldReport.com. There is a link there as well for you to click on and shoot us an email. And we do love hearing from people. Thank you, everybody, for writing in. So that's going to wrap up the show this week. We will see you next time right here on Radio Free Nintendo.
Bye.
Later.
Thanks, Eli. I mean, Xperia player, like, what the fuck is that? It sounds like a surgical device. I mean,
all right.
Oh,
so,
their marketing team is terrible.
John, are you finished?
Yeah, I mean, the only other thing I've played is I did play the demo for Kingdoms of Amalur: Reckoning.
Oh yeah,
that's the game that I've seen Kurt Schilling pimping everywhere, from Fox and Friends to Baseball Tonight. The target audience for a Skyrim yeah. rival.
Yeah, he's all over there. Yeah, and I mean, it's okay. You know, the big sprawling solo RPG is really not too much my thing.
But you just own 8 of them.
Yeah, I know.
3 of them, which are the same game.
Do as I say, not as I do.
They're not my thing. I just buy them.
If our listeners have learned anything over the years, it's that.
He's making progress. This is a demo that he's played, not a thing that he's bought that not played. So,
I mean. Nothing that he's bought yet.